Welcome to the Grace in Common podcast, a podcast with four friends, four theologians from four different countries and three different continents, where we talk neo-Calvinism, theology, and culture. I'm joined today with our normal co-host, Marinus de Jong, pastor of the Oosterpark Kerk in Amsterdam, the Netherlands, and assistant professor of the Neo-Calvinism Research Institute at Kampen Utrecht, Corey Brock from the United States, pastor of St. Columbus Free Church in Edinburgh, and lecturer at Edinburgh Theological Seminary, James Eglinton, senior lecturer of Reformed Theology at the University of Edinburgh, and myself. My name is Grace Utanto, and I'm an assistant professor at Reformed Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C., in systematic theology. We're joined today with a special guest, Nicholas Wolterstorff. He probably needs no introduction to many of our listeners, but Professor Nicholas Wolterstorff is the Noah Porter Professor Emeritus of Philosophical Theology at Yale University, and is the author of many books, too many books to recount perhaps, but most recently he wrote Religion in the University, Acting Liturgically, Art Rethought, and also many others covering the whole span of his career, which includes works on philosophical theology, political philosophy, and ethics. Nick has also written a wonderful chapter for a forthcoming T.N.T. Clark Handbook of Neo-Calvinism, and his chapter specifically is on Neo-Calvinism and analytic philosophy, covering the influence of Neo-Calvinism within that tradition. It's a far-ranging chapter covering not only the relation of these two traditions, but also Nicholas Wolterstorff's own contributions to analytic philosophy from a neo-Calvinistic perspective. So perhaps just to start out our conversation here, Nick, you started out this chapter, and appropriately so, on the neo-Calvinism that you received, the neo-Calvinism as it was handed to you, perhaps in those earlier years at Calvin College, now Calvin University. And we do like to start out our conversation with our guests with the question of, what is neo-Calvinism to you? And are you a neo-Calvinist?
So I was, no doubt I was introduced to neo-Calvinism from my youth upward, but I was became conscious of it when I was a student at Calvin College from 1949 to 1953, because my professors there and the college in general were very much in the neo-Calvinist tradition. So there's one streak of Calvinism which emphasizes theology. In the 19th century, I learned it was especially double predestination, which Hegelian historians argued was definitive of Calvinism. They were trying to find the essence of Lutheranism, the essence of Catholicism, the essence of Calvinism, and double predestination was it. If I ever heard sermons on double predestination, they certainly didn't sink in. Maybe another thing to say is that there's been a movement over the last 15 years in the States called New Calvinism, which is pretty much disgraced now. Well, one of its leaders was Mark Driscoll in Seattle. It was also heavily doctrinal. So the tradition as I was introduced to it in Calvin was not mainly doctrinal. I mean, there are doctrines, yeah. But its core was a vision of a way of being in the world, a way of being Christian. And a common phrase was world and life view. That is, it turns out that a fairly common view of Christianity, Charles Taylor in his recent book, his title slips me right now, argues that it's been standard in the Western tradition to think of religion as an add-on to what secularists think. So we all agree on lots of things, and then for some reason, some people add on beliefs about the transcendent. The Kuyperian neo-Calvinist tradition, in which I was introduced, says that, of course, Christianity involves some beliefs about the transcendent, but it's a world life view. It's a view about this world in which we live and about the life that we have to live. And then it said that it had certain views as to how we should live that life. And one aspect of it that shaped me profoundly was that we don't go off by ourselves in sort of Mennonite Anabaptist fashion, but Christians are to live their lives in the ordinary, insofar as possible, in the ordinary systems and institutions of society. So they participate in Dutch and Indonesian and American politics and don't just go off to Nevada somewhere. And in my case, it was the call to participate as a Christian in the practice of philosophy. So both of those were important in the common shared practice of philosophy. But when doing so, don't be under the illusion that there's some neutral way of doing this, but that one does it as a Christian. Other people do it as naturalists or Catholics or whatever. So that in philosophy, we engage at a deep level the ways of seeing that are fundamental to humans, in my case, in the 20th century. So that's what it was, a vision of a way of being in the world, and in my case, of a way of being a philosopher in the field of philosophy.
And so you said that it wasn't primarily doctrinal in its focus when you were growing up. So how were figures like Bavinck or Kuyper mediated to you in that kind of Christian environment growing up? Were they names on your radar? Or
Oh, yes, they were names on our radar. They were highly esteemed. They were, I suppose, along with Calvin himself, the archetypical figures. But it's only recently when you people published a book on Bavinck's theology. It was Bavinck's theology, or anyway, that I knew much of anything about their theology. We didn't read their theology. It was Piper Stone lectures, his talk about sphere sovereignty and so forth that shaped how we were thinking. Now, that sounds bizarre, doesn't it? That the theology was there, but theology was, doctrine of God was not a prominent thing.
So here's another question from your own relationship to Neo-Calvinism. So reading the handbook chapter, we discussed just, this is the base of our discussion. I was wondering, so somewhere you mentioned that you and Alvin Plantinga, both like from a Neo-Calvinist background, how is it that fitted analytic theology so well? I mean, is there some logic? I mean, it almost cannot be a coincidence that there's two Neo-Calvinists who become like the one of the two most influential like analytic philosophers of religion. Okay. Do you have a rationale for that?
So as I tried to explain in the book, the analytic tradition of philosophy is indeed a tradition, but it's a peculiar tradition. There is the Platonic tradition, and the Platonic tradition consists of certain more or less common received doctrines, propositions. There's the Thomistic tradition, and people have written about the Thomistic tradition, modern versions of the Thomistic tradition, and so forth. And so those are what you might call doctrinal traditions. If you ask me what are the central doctrines of analytic philosophy, that question would have no answer. There aren't any. So then what makes it a tradition? Well, another possibility would be that there's a certain set of concepts, questions, approaches, and so forth that run throughout the tradition. I think it's safe to say that not even that is true. Rather, it's the image that comes to my mind is that of a mesh. I, as a young analytic philosopher, enter the tradition, and there are philosophers in the tradition who are using certain concepts, asking certain questions, providing certain answers, and so forth. And I agree or disagree with the use of those concepts, and then others will agree or disagree with me. So it's this sort of mesh-like structure, and one can genuinely trace it to how it evolved. But the fact there is no set doctrines, no set concepts, no set questions to ask, means that it is in principle wide open to a Neo-Calvinist understanding of religion and its implications for life. Now, all that said, when I entered the analytic tradition at Harvard in the mid-1950s, there was a school within the tradition, which was dominant at the time, the School of Logical Positivism. And the core of the logical positivists, the deep conviction of the logical positivists, was that natural science is the way forward, and they love to denigrate theology and metaphysics. Well, great. So you've got to distinguish metaphysics and theology from philosophy, from natural science. And some theoretical science looks quite a bit like metaphysics, you might say. So they came up with what they called the criterion of reliability. It was a doctrine of meaning. A sentence has meaning, just in case it's empirically verifiable. Well, great. Now you've got to explain what you mean by empirically verifiable. So they tried that, and they failed. When they explained empirical viability and variability in such a way that highly theoretical physics was verifiable, it turned out that metaphysics also was. And when they narrowed it so that metaphysics was excluded, highly theoretical physics was excluded. So in early 1960, logical positivism experienced a remarkable sudden collapse. It just collapsed because it couldn't answer its own fundamental questions. And as I remark in my essay, an absolutely remarkable development then was that my colleague, then young at the time, Alvin Plantinga, graduated from Yale. His first book was God and Other Minds. And in that book, he talked about God, not about God talk, about God. And that was possible because the positivists were no longer keeping the gates, and basically nobody else showed up to keep the gates. Well, for a short while, there was so-called Oxford ordinary language philosophy. Austin and others saying what you could say, but what you couldn't say. But that vanished like a fog over the North Sea. So by the mid-1960s, analytic philosophy was wide open to being practiced by neo-Calvinists and Catholics and others. To this day, it remains that way. There are no established gatekeepers telling us you can't say that or that's meaningless or anything like that.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. Yeah. Something that you write about philosophy and theology and neo-Calvinism in your chapter for the handbook is, call it what you will, philosophy or theology, neo-Calvinism does not see these two disciplines as distinct in principle from each other. What is the case is that they are distinct in practice. Which is a fascinating observation as well. I wonder, just building on what you said before then about what can be said and as a neo-Calvinist in philosophy or theology, could you tell us something more about what you mean there? That yeah, not just in principle, but in practice.
When I say that, when I make that remark, I have ringing in my ears the comments of some Catholic colleagues who said about some of the things that I wrote about God and that Al Planning wrote about God, but you're doing theology. And that was a criticism. So the Catholics in the Neo-Thomist tradition operate with some, what they see as a sharp distinction between theology and philosophy, and philosophers shouldn't do theology. Well, but when I look at what they take to be that demarcation, it comes to pretty much nothing. So what that means is that there's no sharp line between the two. What is the case, as I remark, is that for the most part, if you pick up a book of theology or philosophy or philosophical theology, and you're acquainted with how modern theologians write and how analytic philosophers write, you can usually tell whether it's by a philosopher or by a theologian. Though there is some interesting overlap now, a movement of analytic theology, which quite deliberately blends the two. So is it philosophy? Is it theology? Who cares? Nothing hangs on it.
That's very, well, for me anyway, very exciting to hear, and I completely agree with you. And I mean, just reflecting on what you just said, first of all, that you, the way in which you received Neo-Calvinism was a way of inhabiting the world, not so much doctrine.
Yep.
And I mean, that's why we feel like we have to do what we do in the podcast to show that actually so much of the vision of the world and life view that is motivated by Neo-Calvinism is also enmeshed with this theological reality, this doctrinal foundation for that inhabitation. And I remember, I think reading your works earlier on, is even as an undergrad, and I read God and Other Minds in my introductory philosophy classes, and then read Justice as well along the way. And then I remember reading alongside that Calvin's texts in my theology classes, and also Kuiper in my theology classes. And I'm thinking to myself, it's almost like you're talking about the same thing from two different angles, but there isn't an explicit conversation oftentimes between the two. I mean, there are some explicit conversations, like in Faith and Rationality, that older text in the 1980s that you co-edited with Alvin Plantinga, where you both engage with Bovink and Kuiper in a more explicit way. But it was just really interesting just to see these two sort of conversations coalesce in from two different angles. And perhaps listeners who are curious about this would love to hear you talk about more. So, you know, again, you and Plantinga discuss these issues from an analytic philosophy sort of tradition and mindset. And you describe it as, you know, you chide against those who say analytic philosophy is just rigorous. But analytic philosophy is giving counterexamples. That's more, you know, you want to be more on the ground in your description of analytic philosophy. But Kuiper and Bovink, they're coming from a more continental tradition, role and live view systems, big picture. Can you talk about how that actually helps each other and maybe not as oppositional as maybe some people would conceive it to be?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think the fact that, I haven't thought about this much, but the fact that Kuiper and Bovink are shaped by the 19th century continental tradition of philosophy and theology, and that they raise big questions, I think that has meant for Al Plantinga and myself and others that we have raised big questions. I mean, a feature of analytic philosophy of a good deal of it is that it's minute. It's dealing with tiny little puzzles and comments. I mean, part of it is John Rawls writes a book and then philosophers comment on Rawls and those who then comments on comments and comments and comments. So it becomes very esoteric and fine-grained. Now that you ask it, it occurs to me that the fact that Plantinga and I and others in the neo-Calvinist tradition have not just done this little puzzle stuff is the effect that we were shaped by a tradition which raised big questions. Kuiper and Bovink raised big questions. When Al was working on his epistemology, he read some Bovink, and he was struck by the fact that there was almost no apologetics in Bovink. Bovink wasn't worried about offering proofs for the existence of God and for the truth of the resurrection and so forth. He went ahead and did theology. And that was in good measure the inspiration for Al's development of non-foundationalist epistemology, which then became an extremely dominant presence on the American scene of theory of knowledge. And for me also So the reason I didn't get into the comments on Rawls and comments on the commentators on Rawls is that I had Kuiper's lectures on Calvinism in my ears, and I met people of color in South Africa. And I had a religious or quasi-religious experience that God was telling me that I had to speak up for these suffering people. And so little questions. And so that was a big question. What is justice? So now that you ask it, I think the fact that we come out of the neo-Calvinist tradition has in part meant that we've dealt with substantial questions, not just little puzzles, substantial questions arising in the field of philosophy for someone who stands in that tradition. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. It does make sense.
Nick, one of the things you wrote about in your chapter was on your work on religion in the university and religion and scholarship.
Yep.
And I was wondering if you could describe for the listener about that. It was fascinating to read because it was so similar, so closely related to a book we just translated, Herman Bovink's text on Christianity and science that James and Gray and I have translated. I don't know if you had a chance to see that yet, but... But yeah, just for the listener's sake, if you could say a little bit about how you view your own work as a scholar, Christian scholar, and how those two relate to one another.
Yeah. So that book emerged from some named lectures that I gave at Yale about 20 years ago, I suppose, maybe a bit more than that. And I let them sit around for a while, and then people urged me to write it up, and so I did. So it's a Kuiperian book, through and through. As I said, the question that I emerged from my teachers in college was how I could think and act as a Christian within the shared field of philosophy. And the book is basically about that, not just philosophy, but how we, those of us who are Christians, and it's got application to Jews and Muslims as well, how those of us who are Christians can think and act within the contemporary university. And my chief of foil is Max Weber, because Max Weber, I think more powerfully than anybody else, articulated the case that you can't, that religion is squeezed out of the university, and it's squeezed out of business, and it's squeezed out of the art world and so forth. It's a powerful and influential vision, but deeply wrong. It assumes a certain understanding of what happens in scholarship. Namely, Weber says, scholars deal with facts and relations among facts. Oh, gee, how simplistic. I mean, we don't just deal with facts and relations. We come with worldviews and convictions and so forth, and we see things differently. We interpret them differently. So it's not just a discovery of fact enterprise, it's an interpretive enterprise. And that means that my Christianity and my work in philosophy, in some deep sense, have the same character. My Christian convictions lead me to interpret life and reality and God in a certain way. And I then proceed to, along with my colleagues in philosophy, interpret the philosophical dimension of reality in a certain way. So they hug together, and it's I don't say that, nowhere do I say this is a Kuyperian book, but it is through and through.
So to pick up on the point about worldview there, and something that comes across in your chapter as well for the handbook, that this background in a neo-Calvinist notion of worldview meant that when you were presented with logical positivism at Harvard, that you were able to see through the thing that presented to the worldview that prompted it in the first place. Something that I've been trying to think about over the last couple of years has been the way that, particularly, I guess, a continental, a Dutch, a neo-Calvinist concept of worldview crossed the Atlantic, and then it underwent some kind of Americanization as it entered, let's say, the evangelical mainstream. So I'm thinking there of the kind of idea that you find in Mark Knoll, you know, the Scandal of the Evangelical Mind, where he writes about how the Dutch supplied American Christianity with the word worldview, but then the concept itself changed quite a bit. And what you're talking about is very much that you grew up with a retained Dutch version that hadn't just been reduced to the kind of Americanized, you know, to have a worldview is quite an easy thing. It's that you agree to the next 10 statements, and then once you've done that, you have the worldview. So what you describe is very much the Bavinckian sense of worldview. But what can you tell us, what has it been like to grow up again intellectually with that kind of really rich, more of a Dutch worldview idea in a wider backdrop of American Christianity, which uses the same word, but I think quite differently? So you've kept on using the word and championing the word when some other people might have given up on it because of what it had become in American discourse.
It's a really good question. So I suppose for me, the term worldview, view is important. It's a lens onto the world. It's a way of interpreting, seeing life, reality, God, and so forth. Whereas when I listen to some of my fellow even North American white evangelicals, let's be quite specific, use the word worldview, it's not so much that. It's a set of, here we go again, doctrines, quasi-doctrines, of things to believe. And it doesn't lead them to, it leads them to reject people who have different beliefs, but it doesn't function for them very much as a lens through which to read, understand the philosophical world, the world of literature, the world of social science, and so forth. That in terms of view for them is much more like a set of beliefs than like a lens. That's one way of putting it, I guess. And so, as Mark Knoll records, it acquires often a certain anti-intellectual tone, because we've got the necessary beliefs. We don't have to read philosophy. We've got them. In fact, reading philosophy is going to be dangerous. Keep your kids away from it.
Yeah, just a follow-up question on that. The idea of Christianity and science of the university. So you've worked all of your life within a broad university, right? Not a specifically Christian university. And somewhere in your chapter, you also say something that what New Calvinists intended was not to like have built like a separate culture from your worldview, but to be like with all the worldviews together and like build on science together from the different perspectives and then have this debate together. But there's also the idea of the Christian university, which was also applied by Kuiper in founding the Free University. So I wonder what your view on that idea is. And maybe you can also add something from your own experience in working within a broad university and not a specifically Christian one. I mean, how did this work out in practice to be like working on the enterprise of science in general from different, you're from your Christian Calvinist worldview and then together with other worldviews?
Yeah, very good question. So for 30 years, I taught at Calvin College, a distinctly Christian college, and then went to Yale. In 1978, I and others founded the Society of Christian Philosophy, which now is the American Philosophical Association is the big association. It has affiliates. My understanding is that the Society of Christian Philosophers is currently the largest affiliate of the big American Philosophical Association. It has about 850 members. The number of philosophers in the U.S. is declining in any case because parents think that philosophy doesn't make any money and doesn't bake any bread. And so kids are going off into computer science. A month ago, the Society of Christian Philosophers celebrated its 45th anniversary here at Calvin University. Then I went to Yale, taught there for 15 years. And I became president. I had been president of the Society of Christian Philosophers. I became president of the American Philosophical Association and a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. So I think my life is a sort of metaphor of the answer to your question. Part of my work has been establishing distinctly Christian institutions. Philosophical societies, universities, colleges, and so forth. And part of it has been, a good part of it has been, even while I was teaching at Calvin College, part of it has been participating in the larger world of American philosophy. So I think both of those are important. The result of the grip of logical positivism on the analytic movement was that when positivism collapsed in the early 60s, there was almost no philosophy of religion, no overt Christian scholarship. So we felt it important to form a society in which we could encourage each other, talk together, and so forth. That was behind the formation of that society. While at the same time, we kept our feet in the larger philosophical world. So for me as a Christian and for others, it's important both to talk with my Christian colleagues, sometimes about topics distinct to us, the nature of the atonement, and to talk to my non-Christian colleagues about broad philosophical issues. I've done my best to keep both of those alive in my career.
That's helpful. Thank you.
I think it's just worth emphasizing to our listeners, you know, one of the things that we're seeing today is sort of this sense that there's a post-Christian world out there, people are really negative about Christianity. But one of the things that I say in my students, in my philosophy classes here at RTS, is to say, actually, when you take a look at the world of philosophy, Christianity is flourishing in so many ways. No small part because of your work and, of course, Al Plantinga's work. And it's been an absolute, of course, joy and delight to see it flourishing in these ways. And there's so much hope that we can give to these younger folks, and they don't actually need to be giving in to the pessimism and the cynicism that we see around us, especially through the internet and things like that.
Let me piggyback on something you just said.
Please.
At the 45th anniversary, it was here at Calvin, so I attended. I knew almost none of the presenters, and shortly it occurred to me, my goodness, I knew the first generation after me, but this is the second generation after me. And it gave me great joy to see that two generations after myself planting Alston and so forth, the society is still alive and the young people are coming up whom I had never met or heard of. I felt sort of sad that I didn't know them, but joyful that they were there.
That's exactly right. And again, you see so much enthusiasm because, as you mentioned before, both of you have paved the way for young philosophers to just talk about God,
yeah,
and to talk about Christianity, to not only identify with their traditions, but also to see their traditions as a resource rather than a hindrance for their philosophizing.
Exactly, exactly.
And so there's so much hope. There's so much that's good going on here in Christian philosophy. And I just really want our listeners to hear that.
There are all these talks about the decline of Christianity in America, the decline of the university and so forth. But almost none of these people know anything. It turns out I talked to them about the Society of Christian Philosophers. They're just talking about, something that's happening at the University of Michigan or something, whatever, where some stupid development took place. So.
That's right. And you make that point, too, in your book on religion in the university, that, you know, a lot of people take things on the basis of authority from the biologists or the scientists out there. But don't you see that there's actually a lot of good Christian philosophers who gave great arguments for the existence of God and so many rich reflections on the implications of our Christian tradition for various realms like ethics and political philosophy? So you should actually have a sort of confidence because you don't have the answers, that you have all these actually great academics and philosophers working on these difficult issues from a Christian standpoint.
About that book, that little book, Religion in the University, I sent it to Yale Press because it was based on lectures I had given to Yale Press.
Yeah.
So the editor wrote me a week after I had sent it in, saying that she had read it on the airplane, that she wasn't even going to bother to give it to her other editor. She wanted to publish it. I was delighted.
It's a great book.
Worrying, is this appropriate for Yale Press or anything like that?
If there was,
it was in the minor editors, not in the editor-in-chief.
Wonderful. I have a question. It goes back to what I asked earlier about the difference between philosophy and theology as a difference in practice rather than in principle. For those of us who train people, for the four of us, you know, our teaching roles are really teaching more on the theological, with a theological focus. But for those of us who do that, or listeners who work more on the philosophical side, how do you encourage people to learn to practice one of the two disciplines whilst having this, symbiotic relationship between the two that you spoke about before? So at Edinburgh this semester, I'm teaching a course on 19th century, early 20th century thought. It's called Modern Theology Between the French Revolution and the First World War. And one of the things that the students have to grapple with there is that a lot of the people that they read in this course on modern theology aren't conventionally identified as theologians. So we read Kierkegaard, we read Nietzsche, we'll go on to read Max Weber and Sigmund Freud, but they're all talking about theological ideas. But the thing that the students try to wrestle with in a course like this is, does talking about theology make you a theologian? Or does talking about philosophy make you a philosopher? And that seems to be different in these two disciplines. So when I ask the students, does talking about biology make you a biologist? They'll generally say no. You know, if you write a poem about a zebra, that doesn't mean that you are a biologist. You're talking about the same subject, but there's some kind of difference in principle and practice. So if we're thinking about the principle and practice, or the principle and the practices of theology and philosophy, how do you help people learn to develop in those practices distinctly, but whilst maintaining that close link between theology and philosophy that neo-Calvinism cherishes?
Well, that's a good and difficult question. So by and large, I haven't done much by way of helping students to figure out whether they're a theologian or a philosopher. Just as you're crossing the lines there, in my big philosophy of religion course at Yale, after assigning Thomas Aquinas on the five arguments, five ways, five arguments for the existence of God, I would assign them a chunk from Karl Barth, in which Barth attacks natural theology. So that was no doubt Barth is a theologian, right? I mean, it was interesting for me. I learned after the first time I assigned it that I had to give a preliminary lecture, because what the students found in that section of Barth on natural theology, that there seemed to be an anger that wasn't grounded in the text. And so I talked to him about that. Here's the context. Barth is extremely angry about what's happening in Germany. And he thinks, rightly or wrongly, that the adherence to natural theology is responsible for it. So it's an attack on natural theology motivated by anger. But then I'd also have to teach them how to read Barth. You can't, if you read Barth as a failed analytic philosopher, you will want to dump it into the ocean. You have to allow Barth this flowering of language. You will think he should have eliminated every other sentence. I know that. But let it happen. So I had to do two things: give them the context and help them to know how to read Karl Barth. And then they found it very interesting. So I was, what was I doing? Adapting Barth. Presenting Barth in such a way that philosophers could read him. It was fun after the first year in which I felt a total and complete failure, because they were just up in arms and I don't understand this guy. He's so wordy, he's so verbose, he's so angry. But then they caught on. And in the evaluation at the end, they would say that they found it one of the most rewarding parts of the course. Something the same with Schleiermacher. When I got to Schleiermacher, again, this flowery language and the mysticism and so forth. So for an analytic philosopher to teach non-analytic philosophers sometimes takes a lot of work and skill.
Yeah, that's great. It makes me think actually of the early struggles that people in Hermann Bavinck's own circles had with trying to categorize him, because we tend to think of him as a dogmatician in the English speaking world because of the history of which books were translated, but there are all kinds of different internal debates about whether he's really a philosopher or really a theologian, or whether he's some kind of philosopher theologian. And I mean, there were Bavinck interpreters around his own lifetime who argued things like the Reform Dogmatics is really a work in philosophy, but written in the tone of dogmatics. And people really struggled to work out, can we reduce him to a single label? And then eventually people would get to say, well, he's really a polymath, you know, homo universalis.
My view is, who cares? What difference does it make? Well, exactly. I mean, in the German university, there are disciplinary boundaries that you've got to look, but the American university and the British Scotch are much more fluid. And in a philosophy course, you can read a theologian. Yeah. In a theology course, you can read sociologists.
That's exactly right. So to talk about the blurring of the boundaries between the different disciplines, you closed off the chapter by offering, perhaps we call them vignettes, into your forays into political philosophy, also ethics and arts. Yep. And this also ties into the comments about hope and the flourishing of Christianity. Lots of folks now are, you know, more and more perhaps pessimistic about pluralism, liberal democracy, those sorts of issues. But you've also tackled those perspectives from a Kuyperian neo-Calvinist standpoint, as you say in the essay. And that Kuyperian thought actually fuels a sort of hopefulness for living with deep differences and things like that. Maybe could you comment on your works on political philosophy from that angle?
Yeah. I mean, I knew about Kuyper on political theology. I think what spurred me to actually write about it was Paul Weithman, philosopher at University of Notre Dame, was organizing a conference on political philosophy and theology. And he explicitly asked me to present a paper on neo-Calvinism. So that was what first, long time ago, spurred me on. And person in the audience heard my paper and another paper by Robert Audi, a very different perspective, he suggested that we have a sort of point-counterpoint, point-answer, point-answer, which we did. So a book by myself and Robert Audi on liberal democracy. It was those things that spurred me on. And then when I was invited by the people at Princeton Seminary to give the Stone Lectures on the anniversary of Kuiper's giving the Stone Lectures, that I took as the occasion to actually work out an understanding of a Christian philosophical understanding of political theology, which I then called the mighty and the almighty. I don't call it a Kuiperian understanding, but it is that. Though in this case, I actually talk about Kuiper himself, sphere sovereignty. So it's got some Kuiper inside of it. And then a number of other books, Understanding Liberal Democracy and so forth. That original spurring of 25 years ago got me thinking hard about political philosophy. Yep. What my various answers shows is that I've been the opposite of the caricature of a traditional German philosopher who, when he's 25 years old, has a vision of a system, which he expects to take 13 volumes, maybe. And he hopes that the completion of the last volume and his death pretty much coincide so that the system gets completed, but he's not left with without anything to do for several years. I've been almost the opposite. It is things that happened to me. My experience with the people of color in South Africa and with the Palestinians spurred my many writings about justice. I've just talked about what spurred my thinking and talking about political philosophy. My talking and thinking about art was spurred by the person at Calvin who had been teaching philosophy of art, retiring, and the people asked me to teach it. And I began teaching it, began to think, there's something strange about this Western attitude towards art. It demeans liturgical art, which meant a lot to me. And so that spurred my thinking about art. In the Dutch tradition, Kuiper wrote an important book about liturgy, about worship. Worship was important for him. I knew that book and admired it. It was most of my colleagues in philosophy of religion were talking about either the nature of God or religious epistemology. It was myself caring about liturgy and reading Kuiper's book that spurred me to do a lot of writing about liturgy. So it's, for good or ill, it's been things that dropped on my doorstep that said to me, we want you to deal with us, not some internal desire to complete a 13-volume system.
In that vignette on political philosophy, you mentioned, of course, John Rawls, and you critique his idea of shared public reason. In fact, yep. In the essay, you said that it's impossible. And so we have to draw from our own foundations, yep, and traditions. Yep. How does that work with pluralism? Help our listeners perhaps see that.
So I think that's the essence of pluralism. Yeah, the Rawls vision, which Omni is a vision, he makes it very explicit, justice for an ideal society. In an ideal society, there would be this public reason that we'd set of shared principles that we would all appeal to when we discuss political issues. Rawls said that one had to talk about justice in an ideal society before you could talk about justice in our non-ideal societies, but he never got around to talking about justice in our non-ideal societies. Given that my reflections on justice began from the wronged in South Africa and Palestine, I began from injustice. That's what spurred me to think about it in the ways in which I have. But now I've forgotten the precise point of your question.
Well, it was more so just, you know, people would say, well, if we need our own to appeal to our own traditions.
Oh, yeah, pluralism.
Yes.
So the consequence of that then is that if there isn't, in fact, some shared set of principles to which we can all appeal, then what else can we do but, as who we are, believing what we do, entering the political discourse, doing our best to treat everybody fairly and not shut them down, listening, speaking, doing our best to arrive at compromises that we can all live with, even though none of us may find it the ideal situation. I mean, what we see in American politics today is the opposite. My way or the highway, and shut down the alternative voices or demean them. That's just Marxism and so forth. This is the extreme opposite of the neo-Calvinist vision of politics and a liberal democracy.
Yeah, maybe a follow-up question on what you wrote in the chapter, and also just briefly evoked what you in your work on art. Again, striking to see how much what you see, what you write there is like very much fits in neo-Calvinist framework, like saying on the one hand that like art is kind of a separate sphere, but then also saying that it is a sphere of its own, which also like has to respect its boundaries, if I understood it well. And so what happens to me sometimes when I talk to artists and I talk to how, just as you said, love art in a religious or in a liturgical context. And sometimes, especially when I say I use art in a liturgical setting, they often rebuke me and say, no, art should not be used in that way. I suspect that you would address that a little differently, but I'm just going to ask you that question. So how would you respond to that, idea of like using art?
I would be with you. I'd say you're right about it. I mean, it's an illusion to think that some people engage art without using it. The high art tradition, you use it to give you aesthetic satisfaction. You sit there quiet listening, or you stand there quietly in a well-lighted gallery or museum looking carefully at the paintings. Is that not a way of using it, engaging it? But my argument is then, it's an important way for me in the modern world, but it's just one important way. We have to open our eyes. There is, to begin with, then liturgical art. Liturgical song, liturgical dance, liturgical visual art, architecture. Is this using it? Well, it's no more. It's, yes, but it's not using it in any different way from the way in which the person who engages it for aesthetic contemplation uses it. So in my recent book, Art Rethought, I mean, I've talked this line for a long time, but didn't actually work it out. In my recent book, Art Rethought, I first explore the origins of our modern attitude toward art, that art comes into its own when it's used just as an object of aesthetic contemplation. And then I'd look at some of the important ways in which we engage art, the Byzantines and their icons. Work songs, there's a chapter on work songs. When you listen to the recordings of the guys who sang work songs while working on the railroad, it's preposterous to say that this was unimportant. This was deeply important for him. And so I analyze how work songs function. And chapter on social protest, social protest art. In the U.S., Uncle Tom's Cabin by Beecher Stowe. And between the wars, Germany, the Katha Kollwitz, the graphic printmaker, in all these ways, we engage art. And yes, the museum way of engaging art is an important way, but there's no reason to think that it's somehow the supreme way and that the others are all to be demeaned. That's been my case. Go ahead and use song for singing in the liturgy.
Thank you for the encouragement. I will.
One of the things, Nick, as you've talked with us, has been really clear is how much your work and your scholarship is not just for the sake of scholarship, but for people, for human beings. And I love the way that you end this chapter by saying scholarship is for the shalom of all human beings. It's got a ministerial function, you know, in the way that you talk about it and write about it. And I was curious, to what degree has the pursuit of the shalom of people been the mindset for you as a philosopher from the beginning, or is that something that's developed over the many years you've served in this area of vocation? And maybe that could, maybe you could say something about how you became a philosopher in the first place and what drew you into the discipline.
So it was when I was flying back from that conference in South Africa in September 1975 that I felt that my life as a philosopher was falling apart. I was teaching aesthetics. I was interested in epistemology and in liturgy. And I was still working at metaphysics, and now justice was tossed onto my ladder. And it occurred to me on that plane, why it occurred to me, I don't know, that maybe the Old Testament concept of shalom, with which I was only vaguely aware, was a way of unifying it. So I got home, looked up one of the, I think it was Kittel's theological word book of the Old Testament, looked up shalom. I found what he said not very insightful, but he gave me lots of passages, and I could look at these passages in context. And that's what led me to think in terms of shalom. What I wrote on the matter has never been very extensive, but most of you know him, Rene Van Valdenberg at the Free University is retiring, and they're planning a little fest trip for him. And it occurred to me, on a prod by somebody at the Free, to expand what I've written about shalom. So that's what I'm going to contribute. Now, one more thing. So Calvin University, there's a state prison for men about 25 miles west of Grand Rapids. Calvin University operates what it calls the Calvin Prison Initiative in this prison. And that consists of taking about 25 men each year, almost all of them in prison for life, and giving them a five-year program in which, at the end of which, they earn a standard bachelor's degree. So they emerge as Calvin College bachelors. Every time I've been there, it's been unbelievably moving. These are middle-aged men. They're in for life. They're completely open. I murdered my wife. I killed my best friend. So there's shalom. So first time I went there, it was as part of a course that a young colleague in the philosophy department at Calvin was teaching, Kevin Corcoran. Included in Kevin's reading list, both on the Norcrest campus and now on this prison campus, Hanlon Prison, was my little book, Shalom for a Son, Lament for a Son. Kevin mentioned to the guys that he knew me and that I lived in Grand Rapids, and they suggested, well, why not invite him to come and talk with us? So I happily accepted. Wow. They each had a book, copy. They're lined up when I get there. They want me to sign them, which I do. And they all say how honored they are that I have come to talk with them. I've taught for 45 years at Calvin and Yale and so forth, and I've never had students before line up and say how honored they are that I have come to teach them. They just take me for granted. So Kevin introduces the topic, Lament for a Son, and they start talking. And for a while, I'm completely baffled as to what's going on. I've never witnessed an ordinary course in which the book is taught, but I suppose it goes something like the professor says, do you agree with what Professor Walterstorff says on page 57, or did you understand what he said on page 3? These guys weren't doing that. They would read a passage, and then they talk about their crime. And towards the end, one of them articulated what was going on. Nick, he said, he called me Nick, not Professor Walterstorff. Nick, we have been in grief, but we didn't know how to voice our grief. Your book has given us the words. Thank you for it. That was the most moving response that I've ever received to something I have written. And my word served their shalom.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick, for this far-ranging and moving conversation. To close us off, you know, there are a lot of listeners right now who are seminarians, college students, graduate students, PhD students, and so on, or just starting out in their early career academics and pastors. What would you say to them in terms of hope for the future and Christian scholarship? What would be your counsel to your listeners?
Well, be of good cheer. My counsel is, don't allow yourself to be confined within, by all means, don't allow yourself to be confined within the walls of present-day, highly politicized North American white evangelicalism. I'm a conservative Christian, but I do my best to listen to scripture in general. And that requires listening widely to other voices, not just swallowing, by no means not just swallowing what they say, but listening to other voices, being willing to speak up yourself. It's just not true. So I know Yale University. I don't know other universities. It's not true to say that Yale is a secular university and is hostile to Christianity in particular and religion in general. I found Yale to be a pluralist university. I could teach at Yale exactly what I taught at Calvin. The one difference being that in a Calvin classroom, the we of the classroom was pretty much all Christians, not entirely. Whereas the we in the Yale classroom included Christians of all stripes, plus Muslims, plus skeptics, and so forth. So the we of the classroom was different. So I regularly taught this course on philosophy of religion. I regularly taught a seminar on the classical Western understanding of God. Bob Adams, the chair of the philosophy department, regularly taught a course in the 19th century theologian of Friedrich Schleiermacher. There was a course on Christian religion and law in the law school, on Jewish hermeneutics in the English department. So it's just false to categorize Yale as secular. Secular voices, I suppose, were prominent. So when people on the outside throw bricks at the universities and suggest that we have to stay away from, start the Benedict option because it's all pagan, and then they quote some bizarre voices with no indication of how typical those voices are, that just gives me pain. Don't believe it. Yes, if you go to such a university, you will find other voices than familiar evangelical voices, of course. But you will find evangelical voices. And also this. So when I taught the philosophy of religion course at Yale, there would be 80, 90 students. I would have teaching assistants who broke it up into sections, discussion sections, one day a week. But I would also allow questions in class. And almost every other year, there'd be a question where halfway through, when somebody raises his hand, it's always a male, says something like, well, what Jesus says in John 5 verse 16 is so-and-so. And the kids that I knew by then to be Jewish are, where did this guy come from? So I'd take them aside afterwards. I'm thinking of David. You don't know who David was, but David. David? You can say approximately, you can ask approximately the same question that you've asked, but you have to learn how to ask it. You're not present at an evangelical campfire. You're present at a university. Then David says to me, well, how should I have asked the question? And I said to him, look, you seem bright. I think you're going to catch on. And he did. So part of what evangelicals perceive as hostility in the university is that they don't know how to speak. The only idiom they have is their evangelical idiom. They don't know how to speak in this different context. It's not hostility to their Christianity. It's hostility to their taking no account of how you speak in this new situation. David learned how to do that and became very good at it.
Amen. Thank you so much for this conversation, Nick. This has been a wonderful conversation with, again, Professor Nicholas Wolterstorff. It is on his chapter for our T.N.T. Clark Handbook of Neo-Calvinism. And I hope it's been beneficial to our listeners. And again, if you have subscribed to our podcast, please do subscribe in your normal podcast locations. If you have any questions, please do email us at graceincommon@gmail.com.
Thank you, guys. You've asked wonderful questions.
Thank you, Nick.
Thank you for answering them and for your time.
This was so encouraging, really helpful.
Absolutely.
Great.